This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 6th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you each week by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. Well, we've been asking for guidance from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act for a while, and this week we finally start actually getting significant amounts of that. So we're going to take a look at the week where the guidance finally began appearing. Starting out this week, we're going to discuss very briefly some things happening in regulations that we're not going to do a deep dive on this week, including the 965 regulations that came out that actually started this whole flood of guidance on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act this week. Also, the fact about the sales tax, the state and local tax workarounds, the regulations on that have gone to OMB. We'll discuss briefly our updates on the Wayfair issues, including the fact that this is the week, this week, with the announcement by three more states, we have now finally have a majority of states that have a sales tax have now issued their guidance and the requirements for people for out-of-state companies to start collecting sales taxes beginning sometime for most states, sometimes between now and the 1st of January, where the dates are coming. Then we'll get into the TCJA guidance. We'll talk about the proposed regulations on bonus depreciation that came out late in the week. We also had automatic accounting method changes related to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act small business accounting methods. Talk about those. We had guidance on 529 plan changes that were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and a notice that tells us what regulations will be telling us later, as well as a similar notice on ABLE accounts about the additional contributions allowed by changes in Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and what the regulations there will eventually say. So we have guidance in a lot of areas this week, and so it's time we'll get ourselves running and hopefully get through this without spending too much time beyond what we normally do. Let's start talking about briefly just an update on some regulation projects that we're not going to go through in deep detail. First thing is the IRS did. The first project that actually came out were the regulations on the 965 repatriation rules. Those proposed regulations, Reg 104-226-18, are out. The IRS has now issued them. Basically, they're going to say issues in this area. The one neat thing is there is a regulation there, 1.965-7, that deals with the elections and the payments on those repatriation dollars, the things we're having to put on last year's returns. Those regulations were issued, and they were issued in a way that we can rely upon them, which is somewhat useful. Now, this is a complex area. These regulations go on, proposed regs go on for 249 pages. So basically, they keep running for a while. These regs are not something that, that go away quickly. So we're going to say we're going to have a lot of regs to deal with here. So that's part of it. The other big thing that happened, we had this week, the IRS sent to the Office of Management and Budget. Remember, these regs now go through OMB. They sent to the Office of Management and Budget their proposals for the regulations on the state and local tax deduction workarounds. Remember, the states had come up with ways of giving a credit for contributions to charities that essentially gave funds eventually to the state. The IRS had issued basically press releases and notices saying, hey guys, this isn't going to work. We're going to put regs out on it. Those regs are now at OMB. They went there on August the 2nd. However, these regs were not designated to be the regs that get the fast 10-day turnaround. Rather, OMB has 45 days to look at these regs. So we're probably going to be seeing these regs, when OMB gets around to it, and let's assume that OMB is going to take most of their allotted time. So probably September or October will be the time frame you'll see those regs come out. Of course, that's the other side effect of this. Anything that's not designated for quick turnaround, we're going to start getting the point here rather shortly where if the IRS doesn't have the regs to OMB, we're not likely to see anything before the end of the year. And we're also with regs like that, considering that they're going to take that long to get out, then there'll be a 60-day comment period, then the IRS has to finalize it. The odds are overwhelmingly that we're not going to have final regulations on anything that is a 45-day OMB a review item, unless OMB just says, nope, we're not going to look at that. We're going to have that problem coming up here shortly because we're just getting too late in the year for regulations to sit for 45 days and then still have time to get comments and take care of everything else. So, be aware of that. You start watching these guidance. We'll see what gets in. We also want to start looking for what other types of items does the IRS send to the OMB and say, you know, where they designate that this really isn't a 10-day rush project. You know, what's going to be the deal there? Okay. Now, next up, well, we knew this was going to happen eventually, and it has. A majority of states now that have a sales tax are now having under Wayfair. They have actually now, since Wayfair, a majority of states with a sales tax have now issued guidance where you're going to have to start collecting and paying over the sales tax. In the week of, you know, last week, we had releases from Indiana, Kentucky, and Nebraska. Or I should say actually the week before, because this was an article on Tax Analyst on July 30th that took the count in and said, hey, we're up to 24 states. Indiana posted a notice. They're planning to begin collections on October 1st. They have a little bit of complication because they have a state tax law that had basically a case before the court challenging their out-of-state collection rules. They and the plaintiff had agreed to hold the case until Wayfair was decided. Indiana now believes that Wayfair indicates that, yeah, they have clearly the right to collect it. So they're moving to get that dismissed, and they expect it'll happen, and they'll be able to collect by October 1st. They are going to be using the same $100,000 in sales, 200 and more separate sales tests that South Dakota did. Basically, they also have the issue. They are a streamlined sales and use tax state, so they have that advantage. They look a lot like South Dakota. Therefore, we got to assume that, yeah, they're probably right, that a court challenge, at least a federal challenge, unless there's some state constitutional issue, a challenge based on U.S. constitutional grounds, probably going to be difficult. The state of Kentucky also announced that they're going to start collecting sales taxes on October 1st, requiring out-of-state sellers to collect the taxes on October 1st. They also are using a $100,000 or 200 transaction test, basically just like South Dakota. They're also a streamlined sales and use tax case. It is an October 1st beginning. The state of Nebraska also kicked in, but they're not going to start collecting until January 1st of 2019. They also are using the South Dakota limits, $100,000 in sales for the past year or 200 transactions. They're also a streamlined sales and use tax state. At this point in time, 24 states have announced post-Wayfair collection requirements. Now, you might say, wait, you know, we got 50 states, so how can that be a majority? Well, remember, we have a few states that don't have a sales tax. So when you take those out of the mix, the 24 is actually a majority of states that impose a sales tax have now announced post-Wayfair. Obviously, it's been easiest for states that are members of the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement because they kind of been green-lighted all the way. But other states are coming in too. Expect when state legislatures come back in next year, then we're going to see a whole nother wave of post-Wayfair out-of-state companies need to start collecting sales taxes, you know, on their sales into our state. We'll probably, again, you know, it seems like the states now are kind of focusing in on the South Dakota limits. So don't be surprised if a lot of those legislatures focus in and start using the South Dakota numbers, $100,000 in annual sales or 200 transactions during the year. Be the same sort of issue. But clearly, if your clients are not working on the Wayfair problem and they have any significant sales into a state where they're not collecting sales tax, they probably better start thinking about it now, because obviously the likelihood is that, you know, you're over 50% chance your client's selling into a state where they're going to be required to collect by the latest, the first of next year. They fail to do so, then don't expect the states to give much waiver in that regard. They're going to say, hey, we gave you a warning. You're supposed to get this fixed. Now let's talk about our TCJA guidance. And we're going to start out with the big one. The IRS in Regulation 104-397-18, they issued this on Friday. Now, what was kind of funny was I was doing a webcast Friday, and I was doing a webcast for Idaho, you know, the Idaho Society of CPAs. And we did the webcast, 4-hour webcast on agricultural issues, you know, issues for agricultural businesses under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And we talked about the various things. And bonus depreciation obviously has an impact there. Well, you'd be glad to know we finished the session, and just about an hour and a half after we finished the session, the IRS dropped these regs. So if you were in on that session, things changed shortly after we got finished with that session. So we have these new proposed regs on bonus depreciation. Now, it has various issues in there that deal with bonus depreciation. They start out talking about some issues. They talk about qualified improvement property. Now, that's the property that we kind of know of right now as the retail glitch property. One thing the proposed regs point out, not temporary, they're issued only in proposed form, is that while, you know, they fouled up, they took away the 15-year life for these things. They reclassified three categories of assets effectively into one. They did, I mean, they make some changes. They're not exactly those three categories, but close enough. But they accidentally deleted the 15-year, they got rid of the 15-year life. They didn't accidentally delete it, but they forgot to add it back where they need to add it back to make it work. So we had a little problem there. But that particular part of the law is not effective till January 1st of 18. So the IRS pointed out that if you bought this type of product, which at that point had been qualified retail improvement, qualified restaurant improvement, or, you know, qualified improvement property, the standard category, the version that we had of what used to be qualified leasehold improvement property, that property would qualify for bonus all the way through the end of last December. Now, after last December 31st, when you get to January 1st, sorry, it doesn't qualify anymore, 39 years, and we're looking at, you know, waiting for us to get a fix for the grain glitch, or I should say for the retail glitch. So we have that particular issue. They also discussed briefly the electing trade, re-electing real property, electing farm businesses, business with floor plan interests, that they do not have a right to claim bonus depreciation. We should also add to that list water utility, you know, not water. I'm thinking water utility because I spoke to one, but basically utility public, you know, utility companies that have their rates set by a governmental agency. They also cannot use bonus. There's some that's in there. We have a brief discussion about the option to use the 50% bonus depreciation for the year that contains September 28th. If you don't want 100%, but you want 50, I don't know, it affects your planning somehow. You can do that. But the IRS says they concluded, based on the wording of the law, if you make that election, it applies for all classes of property, you know, acquired after December 27th of 2017 in your tax year. You can't do what you can with the regular election out of bonus depreciation, you know, saying I don't want to use bonus depreciation. There you do it by, you know, by class. So you do it by 5-year property, 7-year property, and you can pick and choose different classes. For this election, it's all or nothing. Now, not quite all or nothing, because in fact, they did say, if you are using the special election for specified plants, and that's one that was added so you could claim your deduction quicker. If you're planting, you know, seeds, if planting vines, trees, those sorts of things, you could claim your expensing quicker. If you're making that election to use 179 on those, then basically you do have a right to choose bonus, to, you know, do bonus there separate from your bonus on others, the 50% or 100% there. The IRS will also tell us in partnerships, if to the extent you have anything that is hitting the partnership, the 743 adjustment, that you also can do separate. You can make it for the 743 items, but not for the regular things that have been bought this year. If you have a 743 adjustment. But hold a thought there, because that whole partnership area gets a bit complicated. They have a definition of what used property is. You know, what they're looking for primarily, they're going to define property as, you know, used property now gets the deduction. But you cannot have ever used it yourself. Interestingly enough, though, they don't define it as used. They define it now, we get back in here, as having owned. Why is that important? Because what if I leased a piece of property to see if it's going to work right in my business? So, you know, I like rented the property for a year, said, hey, this is great. I want to use it. Then I went out and bought it. You actually had used the property before. But under these regs, that doesn't count unless you had a depreciable interest in the property. So unless you had what for tax purposes is considered, you know, a contingent sale instead of a lease. And tax defines them that way. I know we're changing the terminology under GAAP, but the GAAP terminology and the tax terminology are not the same. By the way, the GAAP test and the tax test for what GAAP currently calls a capital lease, what it will be calling a financing lease, financial lease, and what we call under tax a contingent sales contract. The definition of what those two are is close, but not identical. Tax has always been more concept driven. When we go to the new ASC 482 for leases under GAAP, GAAP will become more concept-driven, but they're still not quite the same test. So you have to kind of be aware of that. So if you have an appreciable interest, then you're not going to be able to take bonus. Now, the IRS also makes it clear, if you just don't claim the depreciation when you should have, that doesn't mean you didn't have a depreciable interest. So yeah, you've got to be careful. If you actually have a lease that should have been treated as a contingent sales document, and you just didn't do that, and then you later go back out, you know, let's say at the end of the lease, you go ahead and you didn't have a bargain purchase price, but you decide it still got some usefulness to you, and you buy the property, you're going to have a problem there because it's going to be considered already used by you because you had a depreciable interest even if you didn't use it. Okay. They talk about a lot of special cases there, related parties. We talk about consolidated groups. We talk about all kinds of interesting things. One other interesting aside they said, though, too, the cost of any property acquired, you know, in essence, used property is not going to count if the cost of the property, to the extent your cost of acquiring the property is in any way by reference to the basis of another asset, that much of the purchase price will not be considered to be property eligible for bonus. Now, that's interesting because if you buy new property, so you bought used property and you had a trade-in and you got a like-kind exchange. Now, that's most likely only 17. Remember, like-kind exchange is not to be real estate, but there is some real estate that's 179 compatible, so there's still going to be a few things there. But new property, you could count the whole price toward bonus. Used property, you can only count the stuff you put in addition. That part of the property that's the trade-in value, that's not going to be eligible if you do qualify for like-kind exchange. More likely in the future, where this comes with equipment, will be when you have involuntary conversions. Voluntary conversions, it also won't work there to the extent you're taking by reference to the basis of other property. You cannot claim bonus depreciation on that part of it if you acquire used property. Watch out for that, because I think that's one's going to trip up a few people. You know, it's kind of a weird structure, but it's there. Partnerships, this just gets weird. Now, the IRS takes a look at this. Here's what the IRS concludes. If you have a 704C allocation, right? You've done partnerships before, right? It's going to go quickly because we want to get this finished today. 704C allocations, you cannot use bonus depreciation on a 704C remedial allocation. The IRS is going to modify the regulations to bar that. Okay. That's not surprising. A lot of people thought that would happen because if they don't do that and you use remedial allocations, what's going to happen is there's going to be a huge splashback on the contributing partner. They're going to pick up a large gain. Just think about how remedial method works. And you'll suddenly realize that, yeah, that whole 721, no gain on contributing property to a partnership, will be not really true. I mean, it'll come back to you right away if we're using the remedial method and we could take bonus depreciation. So bonus is barred on 704C property. As well, they're saying if a partnership distributes property to a partner, that will come out with a carryover basis or a basis by reference to the partner's basis in their interest. IRS says the partner cannot claim, first year additional depreciation, the bonus, 100% bonus on that property either. It's used. Now, remember, in the past, these weren't problems because all of these were used property and you couldn't get bonus on used property. Now that you can, they got to clarify this. That distribution, I'm going to say, because it's by reference to the basis of other property, of that property in the hands of the other taxpayer, quote the partnership, that means it's used property. So you can't, I shouldn't say used, but property that you have previously used. So you can't take the bonus. On 734B adjustments, if you have a 74 election in place and you have the 734, normally we see 734 when we buy out a partner who's leaving the partnership. We pay them, of course, for appreciation that might exist, difference between book value and fair value of assets. In essence, we're allowed to, if we have a 74 election, to essentially recognize that difference and kind of, get rid of the recognized gain is really what we're going to do, so the partners inside don't end up paying tax on it as well if we sell the property. That particular write-up for 734, not eligible for bonus depreciation. But And this is where it gets interesting. The 743 adjustment, now, which also requires a 754 election be in place, but that's where a partner buys an interest from another partner, or let's say somebody dies and their heirs inherit the property. And I think that's what most CPAs think of when you talk about 754 issues. That does qualify for bonus depreciation. So we could do a bonus on that. And as I mentioned earlier, we could do a bonus on that even if we had elected at the partnership level that year not to use bonus on classes of property inside the partnership. It's an interesting differential they've got there. So again, four major changes in how partnerships work. There also are some special rules on syndication. One key advantage we've got here is the IRS does tell us that we can rely on these regulations until final regulations are issued. There has been concern about how many of these proposed regs are we going to be able to take to the bank so that we can actually use them and not get in trouble saying, you know, when the final regs come out, we were buying something, we thought it would qualify for bonus, we thought this would work, and then suddenly they changed the used property rules and bingo, you know, it turns out that we were considered to have previously used the property. They're going to say, no, until the final regs come out, you can rely on this. So let's say they do decide. Somebody says, wait, the law says used, but you checked owned. So shouldn't that property you leased before, really that shouldn't be qualified. If they change their mind on that, and, you know, I can see how that would make sense to, you know, to go the other way. I just don't want them to. If they did that, you would still be protected, though, as long as you bought your property under this guidance prior to the final regs coming out. So that makes it key. Now, these regulations are about 120 pages long, so they're interesting reading. I do have a long write-up this week in the PDF that goes through a lot of this in a lot more detail. We also have the link on the website to the actual proposed regs, so you might want to take a look at that. Next big thing that happened this week is Revenue Procedure 2018-40, also issued on August the 3rd on Friday. I was joking that apparently they waited till we finished our webcast and then decided to drop all this guidance on us because it all came after the webcast. Revenue Procedure 2018-40. This deals with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act small business accounting methods. That is, if you have $25 million or less of average revenue for the last 3 years, you're allowed to elect cash basis of accounting. You generally can, you know, not have to use inventories, but you do have to keep supplies counts on hand. You also are allowed to get out of having to deal with 263 Cap A, and you can still be considered a small construction contractor. Well, what the IRS did in Revenue Proc 2018-40 is they have given us automatic method changes for each of those. So if a taxpayer qualifies to make the election, you know, to basically to switch their method based on this law change that the IRS put in, or not the IRS, Congress put in, the IRS has told us we now get automatic relief. You know, we thought we were going to, I certainly thought it would be very difficult for the IRS not to grant it, but, you know, we now know it's official. Couple of things to check. Number one, for each one of these, they tell you which parts of the 3115 you have to fill in. So you want to check and see, you know, you do not have to fill in the full 3115 when you file these documents. That's generally considered, that would probably be, I'd say, good news because having to fill in the whole 3115 is kind of a pain. The other interesting thing, they also tell us for each one of these changes, the fact that you had previously changed the method within the prior 5 years, that normally bars you. So if you had previously changed your overall method of accounting in the prior 5 years, you could not now make a change to cash under automatic procedures normally under Rev Proc 2015-13 that governs this. That rule is waived for the first 3 years. So for 18, 19, and 20. If you change your method in 18, 19, or 20, the five-year look-back rule will not apply. That's huge because, of course, I've had a lot of people come up and ask me that question. Well, wait, you know, we just went over the limit last year of $10 million to become a large contractor. You know, are we going to be allowed now to go back and change back to our old accounting method? Maybe we were cash basis. Are we allowed to go back to cash basis now? Or are we going to be barred from it? You know, we were a C corp. We went over the $5 million limitation. last year in 2017. I've had people, you know, it's funny. Every time I taught the course, I have somebody who has who last year went over the limit, went over the 263A limits of 10 million for a retailer. They had to start using that. It doesn't matter. You can switch under these methods as long as you do it in those 3 years. And here's the other neat feature. If you switched, you probably had a positive 41A adjustment. You're going to spread, and you're spreading that over 4 years. So you changed in 17. So you got one quarter of the positive in 17. You've got one quarter of the positive in, that you're going to pick up in 18. Well, that'd be when you change your method. But there's still half of that difference that's not been recognized. The IRS will allow you to either continue to spread that out over 4 years or net it against your negative 41 adjustment for this year. Now, that's an interesting because if you spread that out, you in some ways are basically taking a deduction today for being fully on the, let's say, accrual basis, but you actually haven't quite gotten all the way there because you got this other spread. It's an interesting planning issue. It's going to depend somewhat on, you know, your client's situation, but I expect a lot of clients will just go ahead and let the old 41A adjustment run out, go the four-year spread, and take the big negative this year and make it go. It's interesting background. Also, except for the small contractor change, you can do all of these on a single 3115. The small contractor change isn't allowed here. Simply because the small contractor, because remember, long-term contract rules are on a per contract basis. Therefore, those changes must be made on a cutoff, not a 481A, not a 41A spread. So because those are on a cutoff basis, that's why you need a separate 3115 if you're going to go into the short-term contract rules. In essence, that's not covered by this. But the other three changes, if you're going to go cash basis, get rid of the inventories, and get off 263A, all three of those changes go on 13115. Okay, submit it with the return. A copy goes to Covington, Kentucky. So interesting aside, by the way, if you got concerned IRS wouldn't put automatic changes out, and so in January you ask for permission to change, the IRS does give you the right now to withdraw that request and get your money back, which is probably the big advantage there, because there's a user fee for requesting it if it's not automatic. So I don't think there's probably a lot of those up there, but if there is, check out, there's a way to get it back. And as I noted before, you've got this interesting choice on 41A adjustments, and that's going to be an interesting planning tool. If you have not taken a look at what this can do for your clients in terms of these accounting method changes, you might want to take a look. Most of these changes are going to be taxpayer favorable, and I mean very taxpayer favorable. So I would get ready to do a number of 3115s. We also have on the IRS a couple of notices that relate to, 529 plans and 529 Cap A plans, in essence, ABLE accounts. Notice 2018-58 deals with 529 plan, education savings accounts. Now, the first part of the guidance is really dealing with something that's not part of TCJA. This is the fact that, a couple of years ago, they added a rule that said, let's say you paid your tuition to the university, then suddenly you discover that, there was a scholarship that you got awarded. So now they refund part of that tuition back to you. You could put that back in the 529 plan within 60 days. They tell us here the rules are going to put in regulations to make that work. Specifically, they're putting in some protection for the, for the custodian, for basically whoever's holding the funds. Because the problem there was that's technically a disallowance. The custodian is not allowed to let you put funds in there in excess of the limits. They're going to say for this purpose, it will be on the beneficiary or the owner of the account to ensure that the funds really are true refunds and they go in timely. And, the sponsor, or I shouldn't say sponsor, custodian doesn't have to worry about that. Also in here, they tell us about some of the rules they're going to have for rollovers into 529 Cap A plans. You may remember under these rules, you can roll from a 529 plan into a 529 Cap A plan for another family member or the same family member. They do tell us here the family member rules for this rollover will be the education 529 family member rules, not the 529 Cap A family member rules.
And that's useful because the education 529, the 529 education rollover rules are, or should say family rules, are much broader definition of family than is the CAP A definition. So that's a useful benefit. They're also give information about primary and secondary education expenses. In essence, that's the $10,000 per year that we are allowed to use to pay for that. They remind us that I don't care how many different 529 plans you have, the 10,000 limit is an aggregate. I can't, you know, I can't set up, let's say, a 529 plan with, you know, an Arizona 529 plan and a Massachusetts 529 plan, and then take 10,000 out of the Arizona plan and 10,000 out of the Massachusetts plan to pay the secondary education, the primary and secondary education expenses for my kid. I can't do that. I can only take 10 in total between the two of them. They remind us of that. And again, since custodians can't know if you took from another plan, they're saying that that also, making sure that's done correctly, it actually goes for the proper tuition and payment, the limited things we have the right to, that also falls on the beneficiary or the owner. They note as well that the expenses you can pay are going to be defined in the same type as the same type of expenses are defined for Coverdell ESAs. You know, they're intentionally making these rules the same. So that's helpful. Finally, we also have this notice on the ABLE accounts, notice 2018-62. This deals with the fact that we can make it, if you're an ABLE beneficiary who is employed and who does not have a contribution or an allocation being made into employer retirement plans, they can put money up to their earnings, the lesser of their earnings or the poverty level for the year, into the 529A plan, the ABLE account. So we have definitions about these rules. And again, we let the custodian off the hook because the custodian doesn't have the W-2. How do they know what the earnings are? They said, okay, we're going to put that in that realm. Also, they have rules there for distributing excess contributions and how that'll work, much like IRAs. We also, this year, they tell us about the poverty level. They define it probably the way you would expect. It is the poverty level for the state in which the beneficiary lives. They note, if you, let's say, had your 529 plan established in Ohio, but the beneficiary now lives in Mississippi, we are going to use Mississippi's poverty level, not Ohio's poverty level, based on the statistics. And so they tell you, you'll have to look for that. And as I mentioned, the responsibility for making sure you don't go over the maximum rests with the beneficiary. Those rules, if you have a client who's involved with that, you want to take a look. These two notices, again, if you have a client that's going to be doing these things, check the notices. They give us the guidance for now. What they tell us is what the IRS expects to put in regulations. I think that's also a pretty decent indicator that those regs may not be done by the end of the year. In essence, they're telling us what to expect in the regs, but they're not necessarily going to have these regs done by the end of the year. Remember, all of these sessions are brought to you by the state CPA societies who go ahead and, you know, allow me to come out and speak, allow me to, you know, to do the projects for them, to do things like Friday's webcast sessions. That's how we end up paying for why we're doing this and why it's being done. So I strongly suggest, A, not just because, hey, I would like to be paid, but B, because we really, you know, it really does help and get better, you know, get you, I think, what's more useful, useful continuing education, to sign up for your state CPA society courses. Just this past week, I ended up taking courses on a couple of issues. Actually, the past couple of weeks, I have taken my ANA courses. I took a full day course in leases. Actually, I took that course from the New Jersey Society because I was back there. I was going to be teaching the next day. So I took a course on leases there. I took a full day accounting and auditing update here in Arizona. I also took a full day on cybersecurity in Arizona. And these are courses where you can do back and forth. You can talk with people. You can learn things. You can interact with the other CPAs in the room. And that's incredibly useful. So be sure to check your state CPA society catalog for these live courses where you can do this interaction. Also check for things like the webinar that I did Friday for the Idaho Society. You know, we can do that. It's not quite as interactive as a live course, but you're still able to ask questions and I'm there live giving it to you. This is not a rebroadcast of something that I'm doing when I'm doing these, you know, webinars for a state society. I'm doing them live. So you have choices for that as well.
Yes, there are rebroadcast versions, and rebroadcasts are interesting, but I really like live, both live webcast or live actually talking to the person. That's just my bias.
This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 6th. Be sure to catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, @edzollers, so you can find me there. I also follow discussions on the subreddit of reddit.com/r/taxpros. I also follow discussions on state society websites for Arizona and New Jersey and California, so I pop into those from time to time. So you may see me there if you're a member of Arizona or New Jersey, or, you know, everybody in the country can sign up for Tax Talk, which is California's program. That's a Yahoo group. And if you have if you want to know how to get in there and find them, exactly can't find them, if you email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, I can give you information about getting onto Tax Talk, which is an incredibly useful resource. And if your state society does have something like the, you know, the discussion groups that we have in Arizona, New Jersey discussion groups, take a look at those too. They're an incredibly useful place to get information and get, you know, trying to bounce ideas off other CPAs in your area. Well, the guidance is coming out now, and I'm not sure if that's good news or bad news, because it means I got to do a lot more reading and writing. But any event, fully expect that next week we'll have more guidance to talk to you about. So be sure to come back here, and we'll be here next week to talk to you about the developments in the coming week in federal taxes.